Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I'm Patrick Connor, of course, of Knuckles and Gloves, contributor to some other places like the Fight City and, of course, the Hannibal Boxing Podcast. And today, unfortunately, I wish I could keep up the tone of my voice and the happier tone of my voice. But unfortunately, we are today paying tribute to Jose Mantequilla Napoles, which means my buddy Arispina, CompuBox operator and fellow fight history file, is going to be joining us in just a moment. And that means that he and I get to remember the life and career and times of Jose Napoles. So, as we all know, as boxing fans, I mean, at this point, if you've been a boxing fan for a little while, and you probably have been a boxing fan a little while if you're listening to the show, people who are casual fans or not really hardcore fans or whatever are probably off listening to other more popular podcasts, and that's cool. But this is a boxing history podcast. And what that means is we wind up, unfortunately, from time to time having to pay tribute or to remember the lives of fighters who have fallen, whether through old age and, you know, perhaps not natural causes, but expected causes for former fighters. But also we've had to pay tribute to some fighters who have died at very untimely or surprising times. Jose Napoles is the no exception here as the former welterweight champion for a number of years. But Aris, dude, we got a lot of history to talk about today. Jose Napoles was a great, great welterweight. Man, I think that's maybe getting lost in the shuffle, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, man, absolutely. You know, it was a tough blow for boxing, man. It's been a rough summer, you know what I mean, in terms of losses. With in-the-ring fatalities, you know, unfortunately happening. And, you know, the losses of Napoles and Parnell Sweet Pete Whitaker. So it was one of those times, was it 2019? It was a full decade ago when we had, like, a similar loss that we talked about before with Gotti and Vernon Forrest and Alexis Arguello all dying within the same month. But, you know, it's been really tough. And like you mentioned about Jose Napoles, you know, he's easily one of the greatest fighters that ever lived, one of the greatest welterweights that ever lived. The guy that fought in a very, very tough division and dominated it for a number of years against absolute tough, you know, top competition. He dared to be great by moving up to middleweight, fighting a giant of a man, one of the greatest middleweights that, you know, we've ever seen. And not only that, just an elegant, classy fighter. Just one of the most. When you watch footage of him, you know, you're just watching a work of art, one of those guys that just made it look easy. You know what I mean? And that's a definition of Jose Napoles. And a nice guy, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, as it often winds up being the case, you know, you've just simply met far more of these fighters than I've met in person, or you've interacted with a lot more of them and whatnot because of your role with the Hall of Fame and working at the Hall of Fame a handful of years back and whatnot. So do you have any... Right off the bat, do you have any, you know, cool stories or interactions with the guy?
I only met him once, actually. He wasn't a guy that went to the Hall of Fame often. I think he went in 1990 when he was inducted. And by the way, it's kind of a sad note, but the truth now that with Napoles passing, the entire class of 1990 is now gone of the inaugural class of the Hall of Fame. I mean, most of the guys were already, like, a little bit of age, you know, when that class was when, you know, first formed back in 1990. But I mean, think about it, you know, you have guys who could have still been around today, maybe like Bob Foster, Muhammad Ali, Napoles, you know,
yeah.
Emil Griffith, they're all you know, passed on. That whole class is gone. But the one year I met him, I can't remember what it was. I was going to say probably 2001 or 2002, around there. I want to say probably around then, because I think he was there when Sugar Ramos got inducted. And I met Sugar Ramos as well, who was a hell of a nice guy. That guy was really personable. He was dancing around and so excited and hugging everybody and just cool and all that. But Napolis was another guy. You know, everyone was surrounding him. He was signing the autographs. He hadn't been there in a number of years. He's obviously a legend, so everyone's, you know, kind of forming him. But the only thing that's kind of funny with me is that I had so many autographs on my glove that when Napolis tried to sign it, he grabbed it and he was looking for a place to sign it. He tried to sign it on the thumb and he ran out of room. And he looked at me and he said, aye, aye, aye. And he threw his hands up as if to say, like, I tried my best.
That's awesome.
And then he gave it, and they shook my hand and I kept it moving.
Yeah. That's awesome.
But, you know, you can, his face, man, bore the scars of many a war. I'll say that. You know what I mean? You know how they say his nickname was not Takiya because he was smooth as butter? Well, he also cut as easy as butter. And the scar tissue that was over those eyebrows was intense.
You know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't, like, fancy myself, like, a super tough guy or anything like that. You know, I don't like to fight.
Yeah, yeah.
But even so, like, I'm not stupid. So if I'm on the street somewhere, you know, like, you just, you know, are watching dudes walk by or something like that, you know, just because somebody's big, like, that doesn't really mean anything to me, like, somebody being big. If somebody walks by, though...
I mean, you're a big dude yourself, so, I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, even if I weren't, though, I mean, just in terms of, like, street savvy, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But, like, if you see a dude walk by, and he's got fucking cauliflower ears... And you look at his eyebrows, and he's got those slits through his eyebrows. You're like, nah. I think I'll stay over here. You know, like, it's those dudes you stay away from. Not the fucking, not just because some guy's big or something like that. But, you know, the point being just that, like, Mantequilla and other guys who have been through it, they the fact is they've been through it.
Man, and when your nose is kind of splattered like a pancake across your, you know, your cheeks, and... You just have those gnarly eyebrows and kind of that, like, the hoods for eyes now from everything. And, yeah, you know what? That's a story in itself right there, and a story I probably don't want to know about because if I confront you, I'm going to get hurt. Like,
yeah, that's plenty.
But it almost reminds me.
I don't need to test myself.
Yeah, of course not. Not to get off track, but it always reminds me of a quick story I read on a I think someone posted it from Twitter. I guess Mike Weaver, former heavyweight champion. Got called out one time at a restaurant by some guy. They were, something went on and maybe someone cut someone in line or whatever it was, but this guy got mad at Weaver. You know, started, you know, challenging, you know, started cussing him out, started challenging, you know, the fuck you gonna do, what you wanna do, all this other stuff, right? Weaver calmly got up and I, you know, told him something to the effect of, listen, son, if you mess with me right now, this is, you know, I'm going to promise you right now, you will, after it's over, you'll be in the worst pain you ever experienced in your life, and there'll be nothing you ever, like, experience like that. So it's best you just leave me alone because it's not going to end well for you. And when he said that, the guy's girlfriend grabbed him and said, stop trying to act like you're all tough all the time, telling her boyfriend, like, pulled him away because I think she got the hint.
Sometimes, man, like that viral video that was going around a couple weeks ago, that old head with the hat on knocking out that young fool who was, like, you know, getting the better of him and smacking him around. And he's just like, nope, come on back here, young whippersnapper. Ba-boop, boop, you know.
Or Rocky Lockridge is one piece in that dude on the street.
Yup. When old Bloodhead is walking down the convenience store sidewalk, just whack. No, I
and
mean,
Lockridge
how many...
wearing a suit when he did that, too.
Well, and how many times have we... seen that story where, you know, ex-boxer knocks out thief, ex-boxer tangled, you know, it's like an age-old tale, dude. And Jose Napolis, despite the fact that he had a very slick style, despite the fact that he was, he could hit. It wasn't that he couldn't, you know, didn't have power. It was just that he definitely adopted that... highly valued Cuban slickness, that kind of innate slickness that seems to come from that Cuban school of boxing. I mean, Jose Napolis actually has a really, really interesting story. And as you know, because I sent it to you, I wrote something about Jose Napolis, and it was a couple days after his death, and I was expecting to get it published somewhere. And it just didn't happen. And then by the time I found out it wasn't going to happen, it was kind of like, well, as awful as this is to say, it had just passed through the news cycle. And then on top of that, I had seen that, for instance, Carlos Acevedo, who writes for Hannibal Boxing and also contributes a number of other places and is a fantastic writer, he had written something, awesome writer, and he had written something not the same, but definitely similar, and touched on a few of the same points. And I was kind of like, well, I don't really want to push it then, because I don't want to like be like, oh, well, here's me, Patrick. I need to get my Jose Napoles story out. Like, no, I don't need to. It's, you know, I feel how I feel, and that's okay. But his story is really, really interesting. And despite the fact that Carlos did a great job on his story, I noticed that there were a number of pieces of his story and a number of aspects of his story that just weren't really pressed by anybody in the media. And I think that now in 2019 just really could, like, we could use this lesson. You know, we got this guy from, you know, a dark-skinned, not super dark-skinned Cuban, but a dark-skinned Cuban with, you know, he's got a fro, he's got the dirty mustache, he's got a slicker style. He, despite being a dark-skinned dude with a slick style, is able to go to Mexico and not only have success, but, like, become Mexican.
You know? Yeah, and that's where he was based out of, absolutely.
In 2019, that's something that I think that I'm not trying to be bleeding heart or like, you know, press too hard on this, but nonetheless, I think in 2019, that's something that we could really stand to absorb, you know?
Most definitely. It's not something, now more than ever.
Yeah. It's as anybody who has listened to any of the boxing history episodes, know, I love to get into the kind of like, the backstory of stuff or the story that like people don't generally bring up or new things. I like to introduce new things. And a couple weeks ago, so since you brought it up, I had sent you the article that I had found as I was doing research for what I was writing about Jose Napoles and his death and his kind of backstory and stuff. And so, of course, as everybody knows, and it is true, his nickname, Mantequilla, it means butter in Spanish, and that so the idea being you're slick as butter. And that's what everybody says, you know, that's pretty much what everybody said in their obituary or in their story about Jose Napoles, and that's true. However, something I've never seen anybody in the, you know, recent years ever mention is specifically how he got that story. And, I mean, I'll just quote it. I sent it to you. You read it. But, I mean, it was so exquisite that I was like, I gotta keep this, and I need to tell this story to somebody so somebody knows it, because I can't just have this to myself. Somebody needs to enjoy this with me. So here was this excerpt from an article about Jose Napoles from, I would have to double check, but I believe it was 74. Anyway, born in Cuba April 13th, 1940, Napoles began fighting when he was 11. He picked up the nickname Mantequilla, butter, at the same time. Grinning, Napoles told how he acquired the name. It was my 11th birthday and I saw this beautiful woman. Her name was Maleno. She was big and strong. She had this great behind, he added, the grin gaining ground on his expressive face. In other words, she had a fat ass. I had no bad intentions. We hugged. She was taller, so I ended up grabbing that behind. She started punching me, and I started punching back. After a pause for some laughter, Napoles continued, my uncle asked Maleno if she hit me. She said she tried, but I was very, very slick. My uncle said it was because I was trying to hit Mantequilla. And I can almost guarantee you that there are so few people who have read that excerpt from that single interview.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Now
I
you
never
know.
Knew that story until he told me that, and I was cracking up laughing.
I didn't either. I just couldn't keep it to myself. When I saw it, I was like, wait, what? I thought it was just some random, you know, caught it, you know, got the nickname in the gym thing, you know, he's slick.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Nah, that's awesome.
I mean, that's a hell of a way to get
Don't get me wrong. The sexual assault is not awesome. But the fact that he got his nickname in that manner is awesome.
And that he can, like, say that proudly and still laugh about it and everything is pretty awesome. But, you know, Jesus the thing Christ. That you mentioned with Annapolis was that the reason why he became a national icon in Mexico is because he was forced to defect over there after Castro banned pro sports, you know, and boxing and stuff like that in, what was it, 1961?
Yeah, basically what, when Castro's government took over, shortly thereafter, they basically said no professional sports. I think there was like maybe two or three professional sports that were allowed to still go on. But boxing was one of baseball and boxing. Yeah, baseball and boxing were one of the big ones where they said no more pro sports. Like, we will still foster like the amateur kind of farm programs, but there's nobody's going to be getting paid for it. And yeah, that's what wound up happening.
Yeah, and you know, he took his base of operations to Mexico and, you know, became absolute national treasure over there. Like, we're talking, he was the main guy that everyone like adored and like looked upon and stuff like that right before, you know, even while the Zarates and other ones were already coming on the scene. By the time he retired, when he was stopped in, what was it, 1975 against John H. Tracy, he was like an absolute treasure in that country, and it remained that way up until his death. You know, Annapolis was just basically an adopted Mexican after that point. And rightfully so. When I first started learning about the sport and all that, and it's always Annapolis from Mexico, you know, it was kind of one of those things that, like, you just I just took it as fact. And then, you know, before I got, like, more involved in reading about his career and stuff like that. But, you know, the way he came up, man, he fought a hell of a lot of competition and a lot of different styles and a lot of badasses. You know, he didn't even come out unscathed in all of them. He fought one guy, journeyman who was tough as nails by the name of L.C. Morgan, won a couple of times against him and then suffered his first stoppage loss, which would become a reoccurring theme throughout his career on cuts. And what was it, like the second or third fight? Also lost a couple of fights early on in his career. But at the same time, you know, I think he was a lightweight as well. From lightweight to welterweight, this dude was just, you know, trouncing competition and fighting absolute, you know, really top guys like the journeyman I've mentioned before, Eddie Pace, who had a really bad record but had posted wins against a lot of credible competition. And he also posted a win against, you know, the criminally underrated Eddie Perkins.
And he actually, and to kind of just piggyback off of what you were saying, whenever I had read about Annapolis when I was, you know, a little bit younger, it was always in the context of him being Mexican. I didn't even know he was Cuban, for real.
Yeah.
I just figured he was just a dark-skinned Mexican. I mean, whatever. Dude, Mexico's a big-ass place. There's all sorts of phenotypes, dude. There's blonde Mexicans, you know, blue-eyed Mexicans. So I didn't even think twice about it. And then when you hear the story, though, it's actually – it's nuts. It's crazy.
No, it really is. And it makes you think – and I just thought of this right now, actually. Like, you know, a fight that – something that never gets brought up, not to jump off course, but like – when Annapolis lost his title to John H. Tracy, that fight happened in Mexico City, right? In like a bull ring or something? Outside arena or whatever it was? But it was in Mexico, correct?
You said, John H. Tracy? Yeah, it was in Mexico City.
Yeah, that fight was in Mexico, yeah. That, you know, in terms of like British boxing history, that's a fight that rarely gets mentioned for like one of the big wins for Brits, I think. I don't know. I never hear it get talked about too often.
That should definitely be toward the top, especially if it were in the, you know, in the context of a Britain going, you know, abroad and
like
winning,
you always hear Lloyd
in hostile territory.
Yeah. You always hear about, obviously, Lloyd Hunnigan, Donald Curry, and, you know, Randy Turpin beating Sugar Ray Robinson is a big upset, even though that was on his own turf. But, like, you know, Tracy going and beating Annapolis, even though Annapolis was past it at that point. You know, he had to go through hell and brimfire in that fight. He got dropped and beat up early on before he came back and busted him up. So,
well, and actually there's a tiny piece of that kind of beginning story puzzle that should probably be told too, with as far as like, you know, the moving the base of operations to Mexico and how everything got moved there. You know, even gave John H. Tracy the opportunity to win something in Mexico. But the guy who actually, you know, set everything up and had wound up managing Annapolis and wound up, you know, making all of this stuff happen was a guy named Carlos Conde. He often went by the name Cuco Conde.
Mm-hmm.
So as everybody knows, even now in Cuba, baseball is still very popular. It's baseball and boxing, and it wasn't much different then. And at that point, Carlos Conde, he was a sportscaster. He was a writer and a sportscaster. I believe he had a radio show. He also did fight managing and promoting. And he basically had this vast network of contacts and also fighters in Cuba. And so when Castro's government took over, he was seen as somebody who needed to be dealt with, like, pretty quickly, because he had these immediate connections to professional athletes, right? Like, he was one of the most important people business-wise in Cuba when, as far as professional sports went at the time. So what he wound up doing was he super hush-hush fled the country, and he wound up smuggling a handful of fighters with him. And he wound up making – excuse me, I have a little bit of a sore throat. He wound up making his way back to Cuba and, you know, going back and forth from Cuba to Mexico semi-discreetly to either take fighters with him or to set up business deals or whatever the case was. And so the probably the five best-known fighters that he took with him from Cuba to Mexico – were Luis Rodriguez, El Feo, Florentino Fernandez, you know, he's a welterweight and middleweight contender in the 1960s.
Absolute monster.
Very heavy puncher, you know, not the greatest record, but not a guy you could sleep on, and a guy, Ruben Carter's knockout of him.
Elbow with a hook.
And Ruben Hurricane Carter knocking him out the way he did, it's one of the scarier knockouts you're going to see, especially from that era.
Yeah,
and then another guy, Doug Vaillant, I guess it would be Vaillant. Sugar Ramos, of course, and Jose Napoles. Those are the five
probably. What about
Jose Libra?
Did he get based out of – no, he was in Miami. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And he was – well, he there was a connection there, yes, but that was a little bit before. That was a handful of years before. And what wound up happening was that Luis Rodriguez, Florentino Fernandez, and Vaillant were all sent to Angelo Dundee in Miami.
Yeah.
And Cuco Conde, he hung on to Sugar Ramos and Jose Napoles, and then basically just took them with him into Mexico City. And the fact that Sugar Ramos was so successful as is automatically kind of gave Carlos Conde some, it kind of greased the rails a little bit for him to be able to assimilate into the culture a little bit easier or get some credibility in the boxing circles, which he did get. And then on top of that, that wound up kind of giving him the leverage to put guys like Jose Napoles on these other, on these cards. And Jose Napoles was very, very talented even at this time. So it wasn't even like he was, you know, it wasn't a difficult sell is what I'm trying to say. It was it was pretty quickly recognized that he was obviously talented. And on top of that, he wasn't just a slick fighter, though, because he did have a mean streak. And if you did punch him, he was the type of guy who wanted to get your back. And he wasn't just pure chess. So that part of that kind of beginning story is super interesting. Oh, and I'm sorry, one last little piece before I cut myself loose here and stop ranting. But another really important part of the Jose Napoles saga is the fact that there was an old fighter named – he went by Kid Rapidez, and he had actually wound up training – a number of other fighters. It wasn't just Jose Napoles, but he wound up also leaving Cuba and getting involved in Mexican boxing circles, and was basically always with Jose Napoles for the most part, and was a guy that was kind of associated with him for a number of years. I'm pretty sure he wound up fighting Carlos Conde's like brother or something like that at some point. Anyway, he's also a pretty important piece of this story because he trained Jose Napoles for the vast majority of his career.
You saw the results from that. But,
yep.
You know, what people most remember about him, obviously, is his welterweight reign and his, you know, his run as being a legendary champion. Even with the hiccup with that, you know, one incident in Syracuse against Billy Backus. But besides that, Napoli's dominated in an era that was like really, really deep for welterweight contenders. You know what I mean? Like, we're talking, and by the time Napoli's became champion, you gotta understand already at that point, he already had a long career. You know, at that, he already fought a long career. He already fought a bunch of different guys, various faces, stuff like that. And then in his first title fight, he had to fight, you know, Curtis Cokes, who not only was a formidable champion, was a future Hall of Famer who was, you know, a damn right good fighter in his own right. Like, Cokes could fight. And he was tall, he was lanky, he could box. He just wasn't a guy that was easy to fight. And Napoli's trounced him twice. You know, it wasn't that they were, like, easy blowouts and nothing like that. I mean, he had to take some hell back and stuff. But, I mean, he beat Cokes up and stopped him twice, and that wasn't easy to do against a guy of Cokes' caliber. And then from there, he just went on an incredible run. You know, he beat Emil Griffith when Griffith was still, like, in, it wasn't like a washed-up Griffith in the 70s was going through the motions. This was like a Griffith who still had it a little bit. And, you know, Napoli's pasted him. He fought guys like Clyde Gray, Armando Muniz, Ernie Little Red Lopez, Hedgman Lewis, who probably would have been champion in any other era except the one he was in. Like, this was a wide array of different guys and guys who would have been champions in other eras, and Napoli's was the king of all of them. And the only time he lost was when he fought, you know, what was it, like a 10-1 underdog in Billy Backus, and Backus somehow, you know, happened to cut his eyes up, and Napoli's
yep.
had to get stopped in that fight. And, of course,
well,
it happened to happen.
No, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
And the fact that I think it took place in Syracuse, correct me if I'm wrong, but I
yep.
think it took place, yeah, at the that
and,
probably
and,
made.
And who do we know that's from Syracuse? And who do we know that's from Syracuse?
Yeah.
And what relation does Carmen Basilio have to Billy Backus?
That was his uncle.
And ba-bang, bang, boom, you know what I'm saying?
But
you know,
exactly.
he has, and I'm not saying anything was necessarily, you know, happening. I'm just saying, as we all know, there's an advantage to fighting in your backyard or to being the relative of a super famous, you know, somebody everybody loves, you know, the upstate onion
yeah.
farmer, Carmen Basilio, you know, one of the nicest possible guys you could ever meet or used to be, sorry, one of the nicest possible guys you could ever met in boxing and was always at the Hall of Fame. I'm not talking like I was there. I've heard this so many times I could just repeat it myself, but, you know, it's, I think that there's
nothing bad to say about him.
No, I mean, there was nothing at all, and there was just a clear, despite the fact that he was an underdog, an obvious underdog, there was just a clear, you know, channel for him to win that fight if he could just set up, you know, the perfect opportunity, which he did. And unfortunately,
yeah.
Napoli's, the skin over his eyes were just thin, dude.
And that's how, you know, he would lose certain fights. And that's exactly what happened with that one. And that's not to say back it was a major fluke. I mean, it was to a degree because in all and out in their rematch, Napoli's beat the hell out of him. Backus, you know, hung around after that. But anytime he really stepped up to world class, he got his ass kicked. You know, Hedgman Lewis beat him around. Pepino Cuevas broke his face in one round. You know, like, kind of leaves you, you know, giving you an example where he was at. But the other thing about Napoli's, too, is that if – the first time, even if he, you know, even if he won with a little bit of room to spare, if it was like a tough fight, he had no problem running it back against you and then beating you even worse the second time. In his first fight, when he was already past it a little bit, he fought Armando Muniz. Armando Muniz is one of those guys who, one of the best contenders never to win a title of like the past probably 40 years. You would agree with that, right? And, he was a hell of a fighter. You know, went to war with Palomino in a great fight, and the first time he fought Napoli's, you know, there was a lot of controversy involved in it. Napoli's was cut up again. It looked like that Muniz was going to be declared winner. Some other scenarios happened, but whatever it was, Napoli's ended up retaining the title. Then they had a rematch, and Napoli's straight up trounced him. You know, that was just the type of champion he was, and he, you know, and he always did it with, like, a sense of class. Like, when you watched him, it was almost, you know, when you watch guys like Pernell Whitaker, when you watch Sugar Ray Robinson, when you watch other guys, Luis Rodriguez, who you mentioned, you know, some fighters, when you watch them, it's like almost balletic. Like, it's an art form, you know. You're watching someone just ply their art. You know, it's not barbaric. It's not anything. It's almost beautiful to watch the way they just operate in the ring. And Napoli's was beautiful to watch in there. You know, you watch him, and you can almost put on some smooth, gentle, like, nice, Coltrane, John Coltrane, or something in the background, and it would just go perfect along with what he would do. You know, similar to like Jersey Joe Walcott and other guys who just were classy guys to watch. Napolis was just fun to watch. You know, he was just an absolute great technician who just took care of business. And he was also daring to be great too, because as you know, we talked about earlier today, he jumped up to middleweight to fight one of the premier champions of all time, Carlos Monzon.
Well, and you know, easily a very dominant middleweight. You know, not in the greatest middleweight era, of course, but nonetheless.
No, absolutely you know, not.
On top of you know the domination that he displayed, though, it was or the dominance, I should say, domination, the dominance he displayed. I think that it was also that he had a very tricky style, like a real pain in the ass style. You know, a really, really good jab, a guy who just would not let you inside if he didn't want to, and
oh,
you know, enough punching.
Monzon, man, with them fencing arms and everything, and
Jesus,
he just
man,
was a
that was a real pain in the ass. Imagine Monzon versus Hopkins, for instance. I mean, that. I mean, I'm not saying it would be a pretty fight, but you'd be like, holy shit, this is the most scientific. Painstaking, oh my god. You know, it was just, he was a super pain in the ass to fight.
And the thing that made Monzon great was that, like, if you watch him, you don't look at him and you don't think, like for instance today, if you put a bunch of his highlights on television, and in today's era, who's used to them 40 punch combination, Mayweather weird pad style, all these viral video dumb shit like that, you know what I'm talking about? They wouldn't adhere to Monzon. They wouldn't appeal to him because they watch him. And Monzon was very kind of, I wouldn't say robotic, but he was very by the numbers. You know, he didn't do anything flashy. He didn't try to go out there and do nothing. He just went there, and what he did, well, he was perfect at. He knew how to throw a perfect jab. He knew how to throw a perfect right hand behind it, and he knew how to keep you away from him while he did that. And there was nothing you can do about it. And you know, Napolis, for all of his talent, for all of his greatness, was not going to get within those long, giant sword arms of Monzon, and he, you know, kind of took a pacing for it. But he did, not to say he didn't have success, so, you know, it wasn't a bad fight.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the fact that a fighter like Napolis, I mean, I can't even imagine, like, being, you know, a welterweight champion and a popular guy, a guy who didn't need to go up and face a fighter like Carlos Monzon, but still going up and taking that challenge anyway. And, I mean, it's not that you don't see fighters challenging themselves these days. It's just that,
yeah,
you know, that you wouldn't expect to see that at this point. You know, like, unless there was something really big in it, like some massive reward or something like that, you just don't see that.
No, it's just, it was him literally chasing greatness. And if he was around today, he would have been a multiple division champion, probably starting at lightweight, you know what I mean? And easily moved up, probably, you know, dominated at welterweight, would have been easily a junior middleweight champion, probably would have won a piece of the middleweight title at that point. But we're going back in time when this was the 70s when, even though I think at this point they already had kind of WBC and WBA and it split ways, but whoever was champion, you know, there was still like that linear champion, and Monzon was the main champion of the middleweight division. It wasn't split at that point, and he went to chase it. You know what I mean? He didn't move to junior middleweight because I think that even at that title, at that point, he almost didn't feel like it. You know, at that point, the junior middleweight title didn't mean as much prestige as what the middleweight title really meant. You know what I mean? So,
totally. Well, and,
yeah,
and on top of that, the guys who were, you know, doing well in that division, he was defeating anyway. Emil Griffith, Nino Benvenuti, you know, those were the guys who were more or less at the top at the 154-pound division, and he was beating them anyway. You know, and a very comparable reign and a very comparable career to Bernard Hopkins, really, except for with the big exception that all of those, you know, title defenses that people want to count for Bernard Hopkins, the vast majority of them were not of the undisputed title.
Undisputed title, exactly. And people try to cite it, I've seen, they try to cite it as almost like saying, well, Monzon's got, you know, was stripped, and I think he, who was it that, you know, Rodrigo Valdez became WBC champion and other stuff and whatever. No, I don't want to hear it, man. Monzon was lineal champion. He never officially lost it. You know, Valdez won a piece of the strap, but everyone still recognized Monzon as being the man. Monzon even came back and didn't duck him or nothing. He fought him twice, so...
Yeah, and on top of that, like, that's a kind of, like, a different... We're not talking about, like, you know, stupid-ass sanctioning body shenanigans, you know, but rather we're talking about, like, there's a champion. You know,
yeah.
Regardless of who any sanctioning body wants to recognize, it is like Larry Holmes. Very similar to what happened to Larry Holmes when he was, you know, whatever title he has, that's the guy you got to beat. You know, and
Absolutely.
Just because these guys are bullshitting doesn't mean that they have any sort of... Anyway, yeah. And so for Jose Nápoles to, despite all of that, despite the fact that Carlos Monzon's got a really difficult style, good punching power, you know, a scary dude who beats the crap out of his wives and girlfriends and mistresses and stuff like that, and, you know, might throw one off the balcony every so often.
I mean,
yeah,
you know,
he moved up to face that dude.
And Nápoles wasn't a young guy when he moved up to fight him either. You know what I mean? To keep that in mind. It wasn't like he was still in, you know, he was probably already a little past his prime at that point as well.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
He was 34,
it was,
33, 34,
totally.
But he was like an older 33, 34. He already had a very long career at that point.
And, you know, I will say, worth mentioning, much like yourself, a very sharp dresser.
Yeah, yeah. Which one, Monzon or Jose?
Nápoles. Well, Carlos
yeah.
Monzon, he was a fairly sharp dresser, too, but I saw him in some of those awful polyester tuxes, though, so I don't know.
Yeah, Monzon, I don't know. I've seen those fashion photos of him in the 70s when he was dating that South American famous
yeah.
actress there.
Yeah, Susana Jimenez.
Yeah, her.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's still alive and around.
Is she?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Like, she still acts and shit.
So, fuck that. I'm shocked that she survived, you know, Monzon
yep.
during his prime years.
Yeah. No shit,
without
dude.
Some kind of, you know, crazy shit happening because, well, that's a story for another. That's a story for another podcast.
Well, you know.
Because literally, you can do 2 hours on Carlos Monzon and just his wild shenanigans outside of the ring. That dude was nuts.
But Jose Nápoles was actually known for some of his outside of the ring shenanigans too. And,
that means
you
got to,
you know,
elaborate because I'm not even aware of these.
Well, that's what I'm saying, dude. That's what I'm saying is I love to bring up new stuff that people maybe hadn't heard or didn't know about. It's actually funny though, and I don't want to sound this. Or, I'm sorry, I don't want to sound weird when I say this. I don't want to sound like I'm overgeneralizing or stereotyping. But I do think that it is something that we see very frequently with Cuban fighters. I don't know specifically why it is, but I think that we often see when Cuban fighters move away from Cuba, I'm not sure if it's the lack of discipline or the lack of, like, you know, being in like a, I don't know, who the fuck is like driving Formula One up my motherfucking street right now? Holy shit. God damn. Sorry, but... What the fuck is going on, Mario Andretti? Anyway, as I'm all trying to get serious and philosophical about what Cuban fighters are fucking facing. Anyway, Jesus Christ.
You couldn't survive.
Al Unser Jr. motherfucking stopped. So, anyway, I think that the lack of, you know, being in a very kind of sterile, almost militaristic training system that they often put young fighters through in Cuba, and then that's the same system in Cuba that fighters go through throughout their entire career, not just when they're young. Being removed from that system, I think, is a cross between a culture shock, but then maybe also a little bit of a relief where they're almost trying to, like, do some shit they had never done before. You know, they weren't allowed to do these kinds of things before, or, you know, it was super strict and they weren't allowed to drink or they weren't allowed to smoke or whatever. And now
yeah,
they are.
I mean, a lot of those Cuban fighters do it have, like, fallen completely apart after they, most of them
right.
moved to Miami and they just get a taste of the life and they just,
exactly. Well, and on top of that, you know, Miami in the 1970s, Miami in the 1970s would have been like the worst possible place for a Hispanic fighter who, like, you know, it did not really
who's been
know much of
life.
Right, or didn't know much of American custom, but then could just basically fall into a crowd where, like, they didn't have to assimilate into American custom because there's so many Cubans in Florida and Miami. And, you know, anyway, point being just that you do see them kind of fall into vices and fall apart. And then this is a common story among a lot of Cuban fighters, and it kind of started to happen a little bit with Napoles, but one of the guys who really helped rein him in was actually Kid Rapidez, because Kid Rapidez had also been helping with the career of Sugar Ramos. Sugar Ramos wound up becoming a pretty hardcore alcoholic. And one of the things that wound up driving to Sugar Ramos to alcohol, or at least according to him, was killing Davey Moore. And as many people know, you know, who killed Davey Moore, you know, something,
bro,
kill him for.
He killed two in the ring. Am I wrong about that?
Correct. Right. But he was earlier in his career in Cuba, in Havana, I believe.
God, man. I can't even imagine. Like, not only killing one, but imagine killing two people in the ring. The only other person
and
I know who did that was, I think, was a guy that Terry Norris fought. I think he killed two people. I know he killed Robert Wangia, the David Gonzalez or something like that, but I don't know.
There have been a few fighters, and of course, for a number of years, there was the thing about Max Baer has killed nine people on the ring and shit like that, but obviously that was not true.
Another one to bring up from another time, but that's just another.
Well, it's just absolutely, it's awful, and the fact that you could kill somebody in the ring, but then, you know, obviously there is the hurt and the tragedy for the person who died and their family, but then also the person who lived through it and wound up surviving it, that kind of survivor guilt, and supposedly that's what helped drive Sugar Ramos to becoming an alcoholic. And that wound up becoming, well, not for the same reason, but Napoles liked to drink. But the thing that he really liked to do was womanize that slick motherfucker. So this quote from this 1969 issue of Sports Illustrated, Napoles derives pleasure from jumping onto the tail end of buses in the company of squealing school children in Mexico City. And he exhibits a sharp eye for the señoritas, referring to himself as the hawk who gets all the chickens, which is kind of funny. It's kind of funny.
The hawk that gets all the chickens.
And it's kind of funny, too, because
in 2019 lingo, that would be, like, all these people would call him a predator for that coffin.
Well, and there's actually a God, now, of course, it like, slipped my mind. I can't remember it, but it's like there's a there is a song by Jose Jose, or it might have been, like, you know, redone by him or something like that. And it's something of, and it has very similar wording. And so I'm kind of wondering if maybe he was just, like, picking up on that slang or something like that. Or I don't know. But anyway, point is, it was funny because that wasn't the only quote that I found about Napoles liking to. I mean, there was also the quote about the mantequilla thing, you know, being 11 years old and he's grabbing some chick's ass. Like, not saying I condone this or that it's awesome. I'm just saying that, like, holy shit, he's 11? Started when he was 11, or at least, you know, at least when
he was
11?
He was a hawk grabbing a chicken, bro.
Jesus
That's
Christ.
That's what you see right there, right? He was a baby hawk.
Wowzers.
Grabbing a chicken.
Well, he wound up marrying a Mexican lady. I'm not so sure how faithful he wound up staying, but he eventually wound up marrying a Mexican lady. I'm not sure if he wound up staying with her either, but yeah, he definitely got into some shit outside the ring. And on top of that, actually, there was at one point charges filed against him for getting into some sort of physical altercation when he was drunk. And so, you know, he got into trouble a handful of times. He definitely was not getting into trouble or getting into dark shit the way that Sugar Ramos was. He was able to kind of keep himself on track. But actually, a funny thing about him, too, as far as being out of the ring, was he often didn't train, like, almost at all.
Really?
There were a number of fights, and he wouldn't say in an interview which one it was. He was like, it seemed like he was almost embarrassed to say which fight it was, but he said that in a very major fight that he won, he didn't even start training till 3 days beforehand. I mean, imagine that, dude. These motherfuckers now are like, I need a 10-week training camp, and then that's after the 10 weeks of losing weight. You know, the, and this guy was just 3 days.
Sounds like Wilfred Benitez.
Yeah, no joke, man.
Well, you know, that's when it goes back to it, though, when you really think about stuff like that, it's almost like it's like a throwback thing. That, you know, a lot of fighters back then were not as disciplined as you want to, like, you know, we almost have, like, this look upon these guys, and we all have a certain, you know, we look at them in a certain light as almost godly figures, and they were Spartans and this and that. And absolutely, when they got down to business, they got down. But to say that they didn't have, like, an outside or demons or this or that is completely just, you know, you can't just, like, what's the word I'm trying to think of? Like, it's like idolizing people to the degree that you kind of almost forget, like, that they're actually really humans and that they still have side gigs and that they do other stuff. Like, you just kind of look at them in the ring and you can, you're convinced how great, you know, obviously how great they are and their success and everything like that. And then you just kind of think to yourself, too, oh, yeah, you know, they were amazing at this. And they are always disciplined. And back in the day, these guys ran this amount of miles compared to this generation and all that, you know. To be honest, those guys had a different training regimen, sure, when they got down to business. But like you mentioned, too, they also had a side of them where, they, like you just mentioned, they only trained, you know, only like a week for some fights and still got away with it.
Exactly. You know, well, I think that it kind of work both ways in a sense that I don't know that, well, damn, so of course now my mind is just going in so many directions. I'm like, oh, damn, how do I respond? Where do I start? Well, because it's like there's so many aspects of this. So there's the aspect where people say athletes are better now in 2019 than they were in 1919. Bullshit. Yep. No, they are not. Wrong. Okay? Wrong. And you want to know how I know you're wrong? You're wrong because there are almost no upper-level fighters that you could name that could consistently fight 45 fucking rounds, man. None.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, is that, like, single-handedly disprove the athlete thing? No. But, you know, in the context of boxing, come on, dude. Nah, I'm not buying this, like, you know, nutrition's better, training's better, they're using weights. Man, they were doing the exact same exercises, just not on a machine. You know, like baling hay, chopping wood, running down a frickin' country road. It's the exact same mechanics in your body, dude. Just because you're doing it on a $4,000 machine doesn't make it any better. Doesn't make you a better athlete, okay? Moving on to the next point. So now that we've taken care of that. I mean, but also, like, there's the aspect now where fighters were fighting under far different conditions. One thing that nobody ever brings up, almost ever, in any of these history conversations, and something that I actually think about constantly, because I was a smoker for 15 years, and I don't smoke anymore, but I still am, like, suffering from the effects of having smoked for 15 years. Think about how many clubs and lounges and even arenas were straight up filled with smoke, and these dudes were fighting in that. These dudes were fighting in that. That you can't even do that anymore. It's illegal now.
A good point of that that you can even mention too is that, like, when, you know, when you would see the guys getting fanned out in the corner with a big towel and stuff like that, one, it was trying to cool them off. Two, that was also to get all the fucking smoke that was in the ring away from them.
Yep. So they could actually breathe. So they could actually get, like, a breath of, you know, somewhat fresh air and not be sitting there also.
I'm a part of that last generation who played in jazz clubs when they were still allowed to do cigarette smokes and stuff like that. And the amount of times I would come home after, like, my dad would take me out and to have me sit in with a few bands. And I'd come home, my mom would just be like, Jesus Christ, you smell like a chimney or whatever. And she would make me wash my clothes and I have to go shower out of that and wash it out of my hair. Like, I get it. I got a whiff of that. Like,
even,
no joke, man. When you can't blind, your eyes get burnt from that cigarette smoke. Like, that's some heavy, duty stuff. And you have to fight 15 rounds while huffing that in too.
There was a while where I didn't even like going to concerts because even just going to concerts, it would be like in a massive arena. It would be like I'd come home, oh God, I stink. And that was even when I smoked. Like, I didn't even want that. So I can't imagine what it would be like. Man, I fought as an amateur a handful of times. I'm not saying that that's the same as fighting as a pro and on any level whatsoever. However, my point is I know what it feels like.
But you still got to give yourself respect for that. You know what I mean?
Well, and the point being more than just that, I know what it feels like to feel tired. I know what it feels like to feel like you got nothing. And then on top of got nothing, that dude's hitting you. I know what that feels like. But then I can tell you that I don't know what that feels like to have those feelings and then also be suffocating because like 4,000 people are smoking. That's crazy, dude. No way. So there are a lot of other aspects of this that like when people are comparing.
Harry Greb weren't real people, man. They were just like aliens or something.
And look, man, that's another part of this is the whole, you know, the Harry Greb training footage. I get it, dude. It does look funny. Part of that is the film. Part of that is the fact that it's kind of wonky.
I wasn't even talking about that. The fact that he could throw 5,000 punches in the fight.
Oh, yeah.
Like, engulfing himself in cigarettes.
Well, and I mean, there's just no context to a lot of this. And a lot of the discussion of, like, you know, that generation versus this generation or, you know, older fighters versus fighters now type of thing, it gets really misconstrued and broken down to like, it gets oversimplified to a level where it doesn't really make sense anymore. You know, saying like a blanket statement like athletes are just better now is just, that's absurd. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever, dude. Just because people are taller or something like that now, that doesn't mean anything. So what? So anyway, but relating that to Jose Napoles, and, you know, I don't think that there are very many people who would watch him fight and contrast him to like a Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson would not do well. He would not do well now, even now in this heavyweight division. He'd probably get crushed. He just wouldn't even know it's a different game. He wouldn't know what it was, you know. As soon as he would go to grab and, like, rabbit punch the shit out of somebody like he liked to do, you know, the fight would get stopped or he'd get DQ'd or it wouldn't even work. But you watch a guy like Jose Napoles, and obviously Jose Napoles and Jack Johnson themselves are separated by, like, 65, 70 years, but still – Jose Napoles is a fighter who could fight in any era. Not saying he would dominate any era, but he could.
How do you think, where do you rank him in terms of, you know, all time?
Man, that's tough.
I think he's number three welterweight, nothing like that. I'm just saying, you know, because I can't stand lists. Look, I've never made a pound-for-pound list in my life. I've never did a top 10 greatest all-time list. I don't do lists. I don't even... I overthink things too much. That me making a list, it would take me a year to make one just for something so stupid like that. You know what I mean?
But I'm the same. Exact same.
Yeah, I don't do lists. I just kind of do general things, man. Like, I know, I like, consensually, I have a top 10 in my head. Obviously, it's kind of the same dude that everybody else has. But I don't want to, like, rank them. I mean, you know what I'm saying. But, like, Napoles, you have to rank, at least you would think, in the upper echelon is like the all-time, you know, the greatest welterweight. Obviously, he's one of the greatest welterweights that ever lived. That's what you have to put him up there. And if you, what you mentioned, looking at his footage, it's not stuff that looks aged or anything like that. You watch Napoles today, he just looks like a classier version of what's going on out there. He just looks even better than that. You know, he's one of the, not to compare him with Robinson, but like, you watch him, you watch a guy like Sherry Robinson, stuff like that. There's certain fighters that are all-time greats that their style will just translate to any era no matter what. And Napoles is one of those guys that, like, he would be a dominant force in any era he was ever in. And not, you know, not like the absolute best, like, he would still be one of the top guys in it. Like, there's only a few guys, a handful of fighters in history you can say that about. He's one of them, you know. And even with a detriment to his skin, considering this too, like, how bad his eyes were and – you know, that being a handicap and stuff like that, and the era that he was in, you know, with all these tough as nails, fucking hardcore murderers' row, like, you know, division of guys with, you know, Lopez and Hedgman, Lewis and Clyde Gray and Nunes and, you know, so on and so forth, Curtis Cokes and, you know, other guys. Like, the fact that he only slipped up one time and with his eyes being messed up, shows how dominant of a guy he was, because I tell you right now, the guys that are at the top in this division wouldn't have been able to go through all those guys without taking an L or at least once or twice, you know what I mean? Or some other divisions at that point. Like, you can, you know, think about Annapolis and be fascinated by how he would have compared against, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard, or if his eyes would have held up against Oscar De La Hoya or Felix Trinidad, because God knows he would have been outboxed him until then. You know, stuff like that. Like, Annapolis kind of fits in with all of them.
Well, and I guess to provide some more, you know, contemporary context, you know, here we are in 2019, and this welterweight division is, I mean, it's pretty stacked.
It is, and, absolutely.
But the dearth of fights.
I love the PPC, but I mean, you know.
Hell yeah. But, well, the, you know, the dearth or the lack of fights that have happened in the stacked welterweight division compared to how stacked it is fairly sad, number one. But number two, you get a fight like Errol Spence versus Sean Porter, and people are like, that's a damn good fight. Yep, right on board. This is a great fight. And I'm like, huh? Really? Because back then, this
in the
was...
90s, that would have been, you know, a main event
that
on
was like
HBO World Championship.
That shit was De La Hoya Obakar.
Or Showtime. Yeah, or Showtime. Or like a Showtime championship boxing. It wouldn't have been like, you know, on the pay-per-view. Or that would have been on the undercard of like a Tyson fight or something. Like Don King would have stacked that up.
Yeah, that shit would have been like... That should have been like a...
Different
I don't know, Felix Trinidad, Hugo Pineda or something. I mean, you know, it would have been like a normal fight, is what I'm saying. But like treating that like some sort of, you know, treating that like some sort of Super Bowl or something like that. And then, so,
put
to compare a guy
like McCallum, James Toney would have been on pay-per-view today. Like, the second fight was TVKO. But like, well, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, there were fights that were like, back then, they would have been like major league... I'm talking.
Well, yeah,
they
didn't put the second one on TVKO though until the first one was like really damn good. You know, like it wasn't just like, oh nope, because of how much money these guys command, they got to be on pay per view.
Yeah, exactly. But absolutely.
And I mean, I'm not saying that the idea of greed is a new thing with PBC or something like that, but it's just that, you know, Jose Napoles, you look at his record, and he wasn't shying away from any of these guys. He wasn't going, you know, I got to wait for the money to be right, or I got to wait for my career to, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. You know, who is this guy with the losses, or I got to build my brand or something like that. He wasn't saying any of those things, dude. He was just like, bring him on. He was fighting. He was definitely one of the guys who was willing to fight whomever. And that alone, you know, gives him an advantage over just about anybody in the current era, of course. And, you know, I don't really like making lists either. I'm not much for that. It takes a lot of time. People get super bent out of shape about them. You know, when I tweeted that thing about Manny Pacquiao probably not being top 20 or whatever, you know, like it got a lot of eyes, and that's cool. And I recognize that I kind of sold out a little bit for people to see it, but at the same time, it was like more headache than it was worth, dude. It was not really worth the headache that it gave me. So I don't really like making lists either, but in terms of just saying, like, would Jose Napoles be able to compete in, like, an era like this or, like, recent eras or something like that? Totally, of course.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's no question. Napoles is, like we mentioned, is a guy that transcends any era. And that's why he was inducted into the inaugural class of the Boxing Hall of Fame in 1990. You know, keep in mind, that was a class where basically the creme de la creme, everybody who was considered the greatest of all time, your consensus, top 12, 15, whatever, that are alive would be in it.
Yeah.
Those, the ones who were still alive, they were included in it, and Napoles was included in that. But
they pretty much had those.
You know what I mean?
They had all of those dudes. I'm imagining they had all of those dudes sit down and be like, all right, now, who has to be in? Like, who do we have to put in? And so that's who they came up with. And they came up with a fine, fine list. You know, I didn't even realize until you had said to me when Napoles, like, I'm pretty sure, like, I heard about it and then I texted you or something and you were like, what about him? And I'm like, oh no. And when you repeated, you were like the, I think your first reply was like, damn, you know, I think that means that everybody from the 1990 class is gone. And I was like, fuck, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is, man. It's sad because I put up on Twitter a couple of months back or whatever, a video that someone, it looks like a handheld recording someone had, that they did introducing everybody into the ring, you know, that was being inducted, at least I was at that place for that 1990 class, and you saw Archie Moore getting there, and Shadowboxing, and Sandy Sadler, and Willie Pep, and Ike Williams, which is rare footage, and, you know, so on and so forth, and Annapolis got it put in there, too. Annapolis was still, you know, a relatively young guy by 1990, at least, you know, in terms of that, what was he, probably like 50? And it's crazy to think, man, Annapolis was 50. He already looked old at a Potbelly and stuff, and Hopkins was still fine, but whatever. And, you know, it's just, they're all gone. And sad to think, man, you know, well, again, that's why you should visit the Hall of Fame, because all these legends are passing. And Annapolis was one of those guys, he didn't visit often, but, you know, he did visit. Like, he's almost in that term, like Nino Benvenuti. Benvenuti is one of those guys that he's only been there a handful of times ever. He went to the Hall, I don't even think he was there for his induction. I'm not sure if he was when he got inducted. But, I mean, I met him the one year that he went. I think he won another time after that, but I got a chance to meet him and stuff like that. And, you know, these guys, when they show up and they're legends and all-time greats, you know, it's a chance to get a chance to meet them. You know what I mean? But a funny about Benvenuti, since I brought him up, this is the funniest thing I ever heard, was that some guy who was a tape collector, everybody's a tape collector, he was like, hey, you know, I got a bunch of videos and other memorabilia I want to send you. He was like, do you have an address? And Benvenuti just said, literally told him, because I heard him tell him this, he said, yo, just put Italy on it. And the guy was like, what do you mean Italy? He was like, no address? He said, trust me.
Just send it to Italy. It will find
yeah,
me.
He was like, it'll get to me.
Wow.
You imagine having that much clout, that much drip, thought, whatever these youngsters use today, that you could just put on the thing, Italy, and they'll find
it. Just send it to my country.
Yeah. Send my country. They know where I'm at.
That's crazy. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, Nino Benvenuti's.
And he's just a good-looking dude, man. You know. He's
the most handsome 90-year-old anybody's ever seen. You know, it's funny because there was a joint in New York. I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I'd have to look. But there was an Italian restaurant in New York that was owned by this old Italian dude. So apparently the Italian Olympic team from 1960, because it would have been Rome, so I'm guessing it would have been 60. So when the Italian Olympic team from 1960, they wound up visiting, and I'm pretty sure Nino Benvenuti was on that team. They wound up visiting New York, and this Italian restaurant wound up catering their visit. And for whatever reason, the owner of that Italian restaurant wound up then sponsoring a shitload of Italian fighters. And anytime they ever came to town, or anytime there was an Italian fighter that was fighting out of New York, they could always come to this restaurant and eat for free because they were Italian and it was an Italian restaurant. Well, now I'm probably going to have to get more info for you because you're probably like intrigued. But the reason why I even wound up finding this out was because Oscar Bonavena wound up, kind of being sponsored by this restaurant and working at this restaurant when he first moved to New York and first came to the U.S. But for whatever reason, you mentioning Nino Benvenuti and whatnot, that reminded me. But he's definitely attached to a whole number of kind of funny stories.
Oh yeah, man. That's Benvenuti was a character in himself, an absolute playboy.
Bless his soul.
He'll find me.
Yeah, that's fucking awesome. Unfortunately, I kind of got to cut it short a little bit tonight. I know we normally do 2 hours, but as I told you earlier, we got a new dog today, and I don't want I don't want to leave my family alone with the new monster for too long. And also, my throat is a little bit sore, so it's like my voice has actually even gone down like an octave because my freaking throat is sore. So it's like a little bit dying. Anyway, Aris, dude, I wish we could stay more and say more about Jose Napoles because he was a true, serious legend. And I mean, especially on the heels of losing Pernell Whitaker, just crappy.
Oh, most definitely, man. It's always depressing, it seems, during the summertime when something like this happens. But persevere, keep them in mind, watch their highlights, and keep their memories alive. That's what we're here for, man.
Right.
We got to make sure these guys don't get forgotten, because like you mentioned before, and when you thought that, you know, his death kind of fell between the cracks, which it kind of seemed it did. Like, you know, it got his proper, you know, people gave it, you know, RIPs and everything like that, and its tributes and all that, but we got to make sure these guys don't fall through the cracks, because it's very easy for them to.
You know, I wish we could even tell more stories, because there are so many of these fighters whose careers and lives have gone unremembered, and unfortunately, some of them are just lost now. Some of them will never rediscover.
Well, that's why, that's why I try to post on Twitter a lot. All these old guys like Jesse James Hughes, I did last week, you know, and other random people that just had weird deaths or
these
whatever.
These are people too. You know, like these are people who had families, and I can't tell you how many times, and I'll try to make it quick, but I can't tell you how many times, and I know that you have gotten some of these messages too, but on the boxing history page on Facebook and sometimes on Twitter too, I will post a photo or a fight or whatever, and somebody will, and so it's usually somebody random. Somebody that's like, you know, I try to mix famous, like, you know, ultra famous fighters with fighters like, you know, you maybe not have ever heard of. And there have been a number of times, probably a few dozen times, where people have been like, hey, that's my uncle, or that was my great grandpa. I didn't even know that. I didn't even know he was a fighter. And so, I mean, helping
that's
people
awesome.
Rediscover that, I mean, I can't even tell you what that feels like when I get those kinds of messages, but in the same way, you know, that's what we're doing here, is just trying to make sure these things aren't forgotten. You know, they're going to get forgotten if we don't talk about them. So.
Absolutely,
yeah.
My man.
So, rest in peace, sir. And everybody, hopefully, like Eric said, you go onto YouTube, go buy Jose Napolis memorabilia, or, you know, perhaps if there's a fund out there, you know, set up to help, you know, whatever it is. And you know what, before we go, I'm so sorry. There was something I meant to mention, because it's important in the story of Jose Napolis. He wasn't just a womanizer. He wasn't just a fighter, somebody who liked to drink occasionally, etc. In his later life, one of the things that he did, he moved to Ciudad Juarez, which is a border town right below El Paso, on the Mexican border. He moved to Ciudad Juarez, and he moved into a little house over there and started training fighters out of a gym. The Baño Roma, Roman bath gymnasium, in Juarez. And it wasn't just like famous fighters. He did train a few famous fighters, but it wasn't just famous fighters. He actually specifically went to that gym because it was a gym that had a ton of little kids coming through it. Little kids who were just, you know, off the street, literally.
Yeah.
And he trained in that gym as a way to give back to the country that accepted him as an immigrant, as somebody who didn't even, like, you know, belong. And so he gave back to his country and his community by helping take kids off the street, helping show them skills, you know, perhaps even giving them a father figure in a lot of the cases, and doing it selflessly, because he didn't get paid for doing it. You know, he was basically just a local hero. So anyway, I don't want to hijack, but I just realized while kind of closing that I was like, wait a second, I didn't really say that much nice, like, you know, apart from him being a good fighter or whatever. It's important to also remember, like, he was a good human being.
Oh, no, he was an excellent human being. No, most definitely. And one of the photos from more recent photos he was taking of him, I guess in the past few years or whatever, was pretty badass. I think he was wearing his WBC title belt, and he had a cigar in his mouth. And he was just kind of staring ahead like, yeah, I was the man.
Yeah.
All hair grayed out and everything. Like, that was an absolute stud.
Yeah, the dude I wish I would have met, but rest in peace indeed. And, you know, hopefully you're able to go onto YouTube, look up his fights.
Legend, man. He's absolutely one of the greatest that ever lived. And like you mentioned, for the stuff that he did, a hell of a human being too.
And also important, go to local fight cards. Go to club shows. Give back to boxing. Make sure that fighters understand that they're being supported, especially young fighters. You know, give them a place off the street to train Anyway, there are a number of things that you could do after all of these shows where we tribute to hopefully give back to boxing and not just be kind of somebody who sits there. So thanks for listening in. We do very much appreciate it, and always a pleasure to do these shows. Right, Aris?
Absolutely. Always on that.
If you're on social media, if you're on Twitter, follow Aris there at Punch Zone Aris. Follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page there. Throw us a like. I don't know what everybody's using now as far as podcasting apps. It's kind of changing week to week. But whichever one you're on, find us there, Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio, and subscribe. That's it, man.
Have a good one, y'all.
All right, everybody. Take it easy.